Two talks on a subject. Today I'm going to tell you mostly about things which are perfectly reasonable from a technological point of view, and tomorrow will be somewhat more futuristic. Now, quantum cryptography, this is a drawing that was made by Chris Fuchs. I believe not his wife because it's sketchy. Bit old. But well, this explains the origin of quantum cryptography. When Charlie Bennett and me met for the first time in Puerto Rico, I was just swimming, minding my own thing, and I had more hair than you. Obviously, Chris Fuchs did not know me in 79 because my hair was this long. In any case, so what this really represents is that there I was swimming, minding my own business in the ocean, and this perfect stranger just swims up to me. And this is a true story. And he starts telling me about unforgeable banknotes. Out of the blue water, like this. This is a note. That's an unforgeable banknote. And so that's really when the field took off. Although Stephen Wiesner, who is looking out there, who wasn't really there, but Stephen Wiesner was really the predecessor of this whole business. Stephen had written a paper on banknotes and multiplexing channels, which I will tell you about later, in the early 70s, and didn't get published. Fortunately, he was a friend of Charlie's. Charlie knew about it and told random strangers all the time, I suppose, until he told me. And and that was it. In any case, quantum cryptography may be the first theoretical and experimental instance of quantum information processing. Again, Stephen Wiesner's original idea is early 70s. Then Charlie and I met in 79. In 84, we designed the key distribution scheme, which is known as BB84. And the first prototype was built 10 years ago. I'll say a little bit about it later at the end of today. Yeah, that's right. In fact, it worked for the first time on the day of our 10th anniversary of meeting in 79 over there. And, yeah, not on purpose, I think. Okay, now let me tell you what this is all about. You've been exposed since yesterday to quantum information, but in a way which is sufficiently different from what I'm going to talk about, that let me just come back a little bit on what quantum information is. I'm not going to talk in terms of qubits, at least not today. I will talk in terms of polarized photons, because it's more relevant experimentally for quantum cryptography. And I will also talk about it in more naive terms. So that's this. He's going to go to sleep. And so let me contrast classical information and quantum information. Now, classical information is what we're all used to in our misleading macroscopic life, and can be copied and broadcast and measured and all that stuff. Whereas quantum information cannot be cloned or copied. Now, let me illustrate what I mean by these properties. Again, talking about photon polarization. So just to fix the idea, I'm going to talk about photons. Think of a photon as it has a polarization, which you can think of as just an oscillation angle. And even though the polarization of a photon can be at an arbitrary angle, it's a continuous variable, And in fact, there's also circular polarizations in addition to these linear polarizations. Even though the polarization itself, this angle, is a continuous variable, it cannot be measured reliably, meaning that these things are impossible. It's not possible to build a device that would take a single photon of unknown polarization and measure this angle and give you the answer. So measuring the this quantum attribute cannot be done accurately. Moreover, if you try, you're going to disturb it. That's Heisenberg's uncertainty relations. Cannot be cloned or copied means that it's not possible to start with one photon of unknown polarization, put it through some device, which would spit out two copies. Now, stimulated amplification looks like it's doing that, but it's not. This is fundamentally impossible, according to laws of quantum mechanics. If you don't know the polarization, if you have only one of them, you can't make more than one. If you had a large number of them, all polarized the same way, then it would become possible. And you could have an accuracy which would be better and better as you have more and more of these things. But if you have a single one, it's impossible even in principle to measure the polarization. Now, these are another properties that were stressed probably in the lectures until now because they look fairly negative. Indeed, if you want to use quantum information to compute, it's not very nice that you can't measure it. It's not very nice that you can't copy it. These are all bad-looking properties, but on the other hand, for cryptography, they're a God gift. It's wonderful that you have information that just disappears before the eavesdropper's eyes, and that the eavesdroppers can't measure, and all that kind of stuff. So it's interesting to understand that some properties can be negative for some applications and very positive for others. And now we're going to do the best for using these negative-sounding properties. And we're not going to use a superposition, at least not in most of my talks. Now, in the field of quantum information processing, the game we're playing, and that's also true for what was done yesterday and today, the game we're playing in general is not to spit on classical information. It's not such a bad thing to have. But the thing that we do is to use both classical and quantum information and make them work together towards a common purpose. And there are all kinds of things you can do that would be either impossible, infeasible, or meaningless if you had either one or the other type of information. But having them both together allows you to do all these kinds of things. For instance, the superposition principle and other things could be used to compute like factoring, for instance, exponentially faster than we know how to do classically. But there are all kinds of other things that the joint use of quantum and classical information makes possible. And again, the first example, as far as I know, historically speaking, the first two examples are these banknotes that I showed before, which I've lost in the meantime. Which is too bad, I had only one of them. And in the same paper, Wiesner had also what he called quantum multiplexing. And again, this is historically very important. The first examples, it's at the same time as the birth of quantum cryptography, and also I think the first example of anything which really has a computational or an information flavor that was done by using these properties of quantum mechanics. In this case, what Wiesner showed is a way for Alice to send two messages to Bob in a way that Bob could decide to read one or the other, but not both. And any attempt at reading one of them would destroy the other. Now, this would make absolutely no sense in the classical world. If I send you a string, a bit string, for instance, that encodes two messages, and if you know how to read one of them, and if you also know how to read the other one, well, then you can read both. But because the information is disturbed by observation. Wiesner dreamt of a process. I'm not going to describe it, but Wiesner invented a process by which he could take two classical messages, encode them in the same quantum state, send that quantum state to Bob, and then Bob could make one or the other measurement, and depending on which measurement, Bob would read one or the other message at his choice. But by the same process, the other message would get destroyed. In the same paper, Wiesner showed how to break his own scheme. But that's fine. We did the same. Okay. Now, what I want to talk about, of course, is quantum cryptography. And there are many, many, many aspects to quantum cryptography. Today, I'm going to concentrate on what most people think of, if they think of anything at all, when they hear quantum cryptography, which is quantum key distribution. And tomorrow, I'm going to talk about all the rest. Now, quantum key distribution, the purpose is to transmit confidential information from Alice to Bob. Now, let me take a few minutes to introduce basic notions of classical cryptography, which I don't assume to be known ahead of time. Cryptographers can go to sleep. All right. Here's the the general context. Let me introduce the players. This is Alice, and there's Bob. And Alice wants to talk to Bob, and they want to communicate. Alice and Bob want to communicate. And in this context, we're going to change the game tomorrow, but in this context, we're going to assume that Alice and Bob trust each other. But there is this bad guy eavesdropping on their conversation, and he's smiling because, in fact, if you have any imagination, you've noticed that they're not speaking in code at all at the moment. It's clear text. So because, and at some point, maybe Alice and Bob will find out that they're being eavesdropped on, and so that's when they're going to start using cryptography. And in the most basic crypto system, you're just going to do a simple substitution. So each character of the alphabet is substituted by something else. And now, in the most classical type of cryptography, Alice and Bob are assumed to share some secret. We're going to call it a secret key. And Alice and Bob both use the secret key through some known enciphering and deciphering algorithms. So we're going to assume no secret about the process by which information is enciphered and deciphered, except for that key. And now, instead of saying this, which is clear, Bob takes the key, takes the clear text message, creates a ciphertext, which he sends over to Alice. Alice, using the same key, can decipher it and know what Bob was saying. And he can go back and forth using the same key again and again to communicate. Now, in classical cryptography, what we assume is that this key is secret, shared, of course, between Alice and Bob, and that an eavesdropper who intercepts the ciphertext but is ignorant of the key cannot figure out either the key or the clear text. And this is a very, very old topic. It's been studied for at least 4,000 years in various kinds and forms. It's in the Kama Sutra. It's one of the... It's really an old art. And really, from this diagram, there are two key issues in classical cryptography. One is, where does that key come from? How can Alice and Bob indeed have a secret key which is shared and indeed secret? So how can they manage to have this key between them, unknown of the eavesdropper, so they can use it this way? That's one question. The other question is, once they have that key, how do they use it to encipher and decipher? And these are really completely orthogonal questions. And I'll come back to the first question later, how to distribute the key. But how do they use the key? Well, again, it's been used for a long time. All kinds of ways have been invented for that. And it's really deceptive, because it's easy for an amateur to think he's found the complete unbreakable code, when it's in fact not that hard to break at all. And in this case, this was done by a Freemason. You know, one of the rules of Freemasonry is that the rules or the tradition is oral. You're not allowed to write down the Freemason tradition. But this guy wanted to write it down anyway, so he made up a code, wrote it down, and there it laid for 150 years undeciphered, until one afternoon some guy from NSA at NSA had nothing special to do that afternoon, took it out and broke it. Or closer to us in historically, this was the Enigma machine, and that's Charlie's hand. No, he wasn't there at the war, but that's the NSA museum. So the Enigma machine also was believed to be unbreakable by the Germans during World War II, but was in fact routinely broken. Was broken before the war started, actually. And today we use things like DES. I think we still use it. But in any case, the point is that all these methods of taking a key for the purpose of enciphering information, history showed us that they've always been broken. So the theorem is just a way of things. And what we're after here is a crypto system which would offer unconditional security. Now, let me explain what I mean by unconditional. I mean that it's not possible for the eavesdropper to learn what Alice and Bob are saying, regardless of the eavesdropper's computing power. So this rules out public key cryptography, and regardless of the eavesdropper's technology, and regardless of anything else. So what we want by unconditional is that there is just nothing the eavesdropper can do to get her hands on the clear text, except perhaps just being exponentially lucky. We cannot rule out that the eavesdropper is just so lucky that she manages to figure it out. But only luck, and we can bring it, the probability of success, down to 10 to the minus 100 if you want. So that's really not a worry. Yes?
You don't allow the eavesdropper to infiltrate Bob's or Alice's laboratory.
That's correct. We do not allow the eavesdropper to infiltrate Alice and Bob's laboratory. That's correct. We only allow the eavesdropper to monitor signals between them. That's an important point. Now, it turns out that this goal of unconditional security has been achieved, was achieved in the 1917, I think, or, well, a long time ago. It's known as a one-time pad. So let me tell you a few words about a one-time pad. Here's the idea. Alice and Bob are going to share a secret key, which is represented here by zeros and ones being light and dark. So we assume that Alice and Bob, here's Alice and here's Bob, and you share this key. It's secret from anyone else. And now Alice has a message she wants to tell to send Bob. So Alice is going to take her clear text, take her secret key, put them together, and she's going to produce, because Alice was here, she's going to produce this ciphertext. And this ciphertext, she's going to send it over an insecure channel over to Bob. Now, if the eavesdropper intercepts the ciphertext, it's a theorem of Shannon that there's no information there about a clear text, except for the number of bits and the existence of the clear text itself. But when Bob gets the clear text, when Bob gets the ciphertext, he's just going to put them together, and there it goes, the clear text. Vernam, which is the inventor of the one-time pad. And now, Bob is very happy to get this message, and he's going to use the same system again to create his own. This was the first ciphertext. So Bob is going to use the same system to create another ciphertext, which is going to send over to Alice. And Alice is going to put it here, so you see I don't cheat. And Alice is going to use the same mask again to read. Gilbert, which is Vernon's first name. Now, at this point, Alice and Bob have, well, if I were less clumsy, it would give this. So Alice and Bob are very happy. They've exchanged secret messages. And they've just, but they've done what they shouldn't do. Because they've used the same mask, the same key, twice, to send two different clear texts. And it's not called a one-time pad for nothing. Because what really happens now is that, remember the eavesdropper, this is the mask, the eavesdropper does not have the key. So that's unknown of the eavesdropper. But the eavesdropper saw, it was here, saw the first clear text, the first ciphertext, rather, go from Alice to Bob, and he saw also the second one go from Bob to Alice. And now if the eavesdropper intercepted both ciphertexts, when I say intercepted, I just mean monitor. They let it go, but took it down. Then just by putting together those two ciphertexts, and if I'm lucky, that's pretty good, you get both clear texts appear. And if I had been, again, less clumsy, we'd give this. All right, so what's the conclusion? The conclusion is that there are several conclusions. One is that even a system which is mathematically proven unconditionally secure, if it's not used properly, can fail. That will also be true for quantum cryptography, as I will explain later today. And by the way, this kind of things, of using the same one-time pad twice to send different clear text, different messages at different times, which you should never do, which everybody knows you should never do, was in fact done in real life, in particular by the Russians sending secrets about, I think, the hydrogen bomb or something. And indeed, it was broken. Now, it's not obvious how to break that, because you have to guess which are the two ciphertexts that were encoded with the same key. But if you do all kinds of mix and match, you can figure out. At the very least, you lose unconditional security. And in some cases, you can even lose actual security. All right. Conclusion. We want unconditional security. It exists, but it costs a whole bunch of keys. And that's why this one-time pad is not used all that much in real life. It is used in some high security conditions, like on the red telephone, if it still exists between Washington and Moscow, they use that. But you won't use it to order a pizza. unless you use the Charlie's pizza system. You've heard of it. Anyways. Good. So now the question remains. Now we've answered, there were two questions. How do you distribute the key securely? And once you've done that, how do you use it to be unconditionally secure? And we've answered a second question. The second, namely that if you have a way to transmit a very long secret key in a way that's unconditionally secure, that the secret of that key is unconditionally protected, then you can use it through a one-time pad to send actual meaningful messages. And that's where quantum mechanics will enter the game. We're going to use quantum mechanics for this operation of distributing the key. And that's why it's called quantum key distribution. But before that, let me just point out that, again, since we want unconditional security, the other way that has been proposed, which is in fact used very much in real life on the internet for sending keys, is through the use of public key cryptography, which is one of the most beautiful inventions of last century in cryptography, but is not unconditionally secure. So just a few words about this before I move on to really the quantum stuff. Public key cryptography was first proposed by Diffie and Hellman as a concept, but they didn't know how to implement it. And then Rivesheimer and Edelman somewhat strangely published their well-known, famous system in Scientific American under the pen of Martin Gardner. in the mathematical games. And that was in the August 77 issue. And in that same issue, in that same article, Rivet Shemi Edelman proposed a challenge. And the challenge was, here's a ciphertext encoded with RSA, and whoever breaks it will get $100. And he felt pretty safe because according to their calculation, with the most efficient factor, well, essentially you would need to factor big numbers to break that in 77. And according to their calculation, with the most efficient factoring algorithm known at the time, using a computer that would be, I think, 1,000 times faster than what he had, it would take 2 million times the age of the universe to break this. So they felt that their $100 was pretty safe. But it took 17 years. In fact, in 17 years, the answer came out. That was a clear text. Now, why this very strange clear text is because the RSA system has the property that if you can guess the clear text with all the public information, you can check, you can compute in one direction from the clear text and the public key, you can get the ciphertext, which can then compare with the challenge in this case. So someone who would have guessed the clear text could have, without actually breaking it, just by guessing the clear text, could have said, I got it. So they had to choose, they just took an encyclopedia and they opened at random pages to find bizarre words so that they would be very unlikely to be guessed. In any case, why did it take 17 years instead of 2 million times the age of the universe? Because there was substantial progress in factoring algorithms. And also because there was much more an unpredictable possibility for massive parallelism through the internet. Because this was broken by, if I remember, about 6,000 computers around the planet. They were all computing on little parts of it, sending information back to the center somewhere in New Jersey. And among these 6,000 computers, there were Cray's and supercomputers. There were also microprocessors and fax machines. And they were all working in the same goal, and after about 8 months of computation, they found it. What's the lesson? The lesson is not that RSA is broken. I would still use it and even trust my life on it, probably. But the lesson is that what was thought of as being a secure key length in 77 just isn't secure. And today, nobody knows how to factor a 200-digit number, but a new algorithm might be around the corner. And of course, if we have a quantum computer, then you can break it immediately. So, the conclusion is that if indeed we want unconditional security, we have to do something else. And here's the idea. I'm going first to explain the idea on a high-level kind of version, and then I'm going to refine the idea to actually show you how it's really done. But on the highest level, we just use the fact that quantum information cannot be measured reliably and is disturbed by observation. So the idea is that if Alice wants to send a message to Bob, now remember that in reality they're going to use that to send a secret key that it will later use to send a message through a classical one-time pad. But let me explain at a higher level than that for the moment. So if Alice wants to send some message to Bob, she's going to encode her message into a quantum system. Send that quantum system over to Bob, and if there is an eavesdropper who's trying to figure out what Alice wants to tell Bob, well, because quantum information cannot be measured reliably, the eavesdropper won't be able to know what Alice encoded into her quantum system. So the eavesdropper won't know what the message is. And moreover, just by trying to learn it, she will induce a disturbance so that what actually gets to Bob is different from what Alice had sent. And this disturbance can be detected by Bob, so that Bob would be alerted to the fact that there was an eavesdropper, and moreover, the eavesdropper will not have been able to read the message. So, to paraphrase Paul Simon, as in Simon and Garfunkel, in Sleep Sliding Away, the information is just not available to the eavesdropper. Okay, sounds good. There's just one problem. Why should the eavesdropper be unable to read Alice's message, but Bob can? How can Bob have any advantage compared to the eavesdropper? And I guess that's what really took us five years to figure out between 79 and 84. But once you think of it, it's not that difficult. So let me be a little bit more precise now. Now, if you wanted to use single polarized photons for the purpose of transmitting information efficiently, now the obvious thing to do would be to use two orthogonal polarizations because those can be distinguished. When I say that quantum information cannot be measured reliably, if you know ahead of time that a photon is polarized either horizontally or vertically, then it's easy to distinguish. So sometimes you can measure reliably if you have prior information. But again, if you wanted to use, polarized photons again for transmitting information efficiently, you would use zero being horizontal, for instance, and one being vertical, and Alice would send that over to Bob, and Bob would decode them with arbitrary precision. But so could the eavesdropper. So we need an encoding in which zeros and ones cannot be distinguished reliably. And the most obvious, although not the original solution, this is the Charlie's idea of 92, I think, is to use two non-orthogonal polarizations. So if you encode zero with a vertically polarized photon and one with a horizontally diagonally polarized photon, then it follows from the basic laws of quantum mechanics that these two cannot be distinguished reliably all the time. Now, let me be precise what I mean here. It is possible to distinguish these two reliably some of the time. And it is possible to distinguish them unreliably all the time, like Kennedy. But you cannot distinguish them reliably all the time. And that's exactly where Bob's advantage will come compared to the eavesdropper. So again, if there is an eavesdropper who tries to... So Alice is going to take zeros and ones. Again, it's a random key. Alice is going to send a random key over to Bob. So just random zeros and ones. And she encodes zeros and ones with these photons. And so she sends this stream of photons over to Bob. If there's no eavesdropper, Bob will be able to distinguish, to read them some of the time. I'll show you how in a minute. So most of the time, let's say three times out of four, Bob will lose the information. But one time out of four, Bob will know which photon Alice put in. And that one time out of four, on the average, Bob will tell Alice by a back classical channel, "Hey, I got it this time." So that Alice, in a perfect implementation, if Alice sends four times n photons, like those, about n of them will be read reliably by Bob. And Bob will know which one were read reliably. Bob will tell Alice which bit to keep, and they have an n-bit string in common. That's if there is no eavesdropper. If there is an eavesdropper, then any attempt at eavesdropping will cause errors, and these errors will be detected. I'll show you how at the end of this talk. And again, we're going to use this quantum channel not to send the actual message, but to send a random key. And that random key will then be used, if successful, through a one-time pad to send a meaningful message. So let me just again see where it is that Bob has this advantage over the eavesdropper. The eavesdropper also is able to read one of the four photons sent by Alice. But there's no connection between when the eavesdropper succeeds and when Bob would succeed. So that when the eavesdropper does not succeed, he has to send some garbage instead, so some random stuff. And perhaps this one, Bob will think that he succeeded in reading it, but it's no longer connected with Alice's. So in the end, the advantage of Bob is that it's going to be Bob who tells Alice which bits to keep, and not the eavesdropper. The advantage is exactly there. So this assumes that there is a back channel, a classical back channel between Bob and Alice, which can be monitored by the eavesdropper but not tampered with. And we'll come back to that issue afterwards. Okay, now let me get into one more level of detail. Using some slides of Richard Hughes in Los Alamos. Now, in conventional cryptography, one of the two parties, like Alice, will choose a random key and find a way to send it to Bob. Maybe by diplomatic briefcase or RSA, whatever. But usually, one of them actually gets to choose the key and tries to get it over to Bob. This is not the case with the public key distribution like Diffie-Hellman, but that's okay. In quantum key distribution, instead, the key does not exist prior to transmission. It's not chosen by either one. In fact, Alice and Bob will each choose independently a string of bits, you know, which are completely uncorrelated. But therefore, about half the time, the bits are the same, just by pure chance. And using quantum mechanics, they are going to make some kind of remote measurements that will allow them to spot places in which they had the same bit. And they will keep those. And as you will see, whenever the bits are different, they will always know that they are different. Or they will always reject them, at least. Whenever the bits are the same, half the time they will keep it. And half the time they will reject it anyway. So that's why in the end, they will keep one quarter of those bits. But those bits which will be kept will be the same for Alice and Bob. And here's the scheme, the simplest scheme. Whenever Alice remember, Alice and Bob, they each have a long random bit string which is uncorrelated. At each position, each position will correspond to a time slice in which Alice sends a photon to Bob and Bob makes some measurement. Whenever Alice's bit is 0, she will send a vertically polarized photon to Bob. Whenever Alice's bit is 1, she will send a 45-degree polarized photon to Bob. So let's look at an example. In the first time slot, Alice has a 1, and therefore she sends a diagonally polarized photon to Bob, like this. Now, what does Bob do? When Bob has a 0, he's going to make the photon go through a minus 45-degree polarizer and see if the photon is detected. Whenever Bob has a 1, he lets the photon go through a horizontally polarized photon and see if it's detected. In this case, in our example, Bob's first bit was a 0, meaning a horizontally polarized, a 0, meaning a minus 45 degrees, polarizer. So Bob is going to put a minus 45-degree polarizer and will not see the photon. Since the photon is not seen, this bit will not be kept. In the second time slice, Alice has a 0, which means that she sends a vertically polarized photon to Bob. And Bob has a 0 as well, meaning that he will use, a minus 45-degree polarizer. And now there's a half chance that the photon goes through. If it does, the bit is kept, and indeed it's a common bit 0. If it doesn't go through, well, it's discarded. It's just too bad. And you see that 1 out of 2, the bits are different, and they will be rejected. 1 out of 2, the bits are the same, and there's a half chance it will be kept. So that if everything is perfect at the end, Alice and Bob, out of their 4n bit strings each, we'll have an n bit string which will be the same, exactly the same between Alice and Bob. That's the basic idea. Now, if there is an eavesdropper, the eavesdropper will try to monitor the photons in transit between Alice and Bob. That's going to make a disturbance And sometimes Bob will think that he knows what the photon analysis was, and it will be wrong. And that will create errors. And any attempt at eavesdropping will create errors. The simplest version of this theorem is that any measurement on the eavesdropper's part, any measurement that has a non-zero probability of yielding information, has also a non-zero probability of disturbing. And this has to be made more quantified to get a real proof of security, but from a higher level point of view, that's good enough. All right, so that's the idea behind quantum cryptography as a theory. Now, can we make it work for real? And how is this going to look like when we really try to implement it? There are all kinds of problems. There are all kinds of problems. For example, the way I described the theoretical scheme, Alice creates this single photon and shoots it off to Bob. Well, photons are not like billiard balls. It's not that easy to manipulate single photons. It's easy to polarize. That there's no big trick at polarizing photons. But creating single photons is not that easy. And also transmitting them over a significant distance is not that easy either for two reasons. One is that if you use, an optical fiber, the most obvious waveguide, then there is loss in the fiber. If Alice puts the photon in the fiber, there's some chance it won't get there. And moreover, fibers have the bad habit of messing up polarization. So it's not so obvious that you can use fiber for sending single polarized photons reliably. Now, the most mysterious part of this story is that Charlie and I had been working on these ideas as theoreticians for about 10 years, and nobody took us seriously until we built a prototype with John Smolin and two of my students, Louis Salvay and François Besset. And this prototype, as I said before, was built, worked on the day 10 years after we met. And suddenly, because there was a prototype working, we were taken seriously. This is ridiculous. In any case, faithful to RSA, we also published Scientific American. And there was a prototype. So this is only of historical value. This prototype, this first prototype that implemented quantum cryptography, here's Alice. There's Bob. And there's a quantum channel over 32.5 centimeters. And in running mode, we put a coffin on top and velvet and all that kind of stuff. And this prototype was the first instance of a provably secure cryptographic apparatus that required only two assumptions. One was that quantum mechanics is correct, and the other was that the eavesdropper is deaf. Because to rotate polarizations, we use Pockel cells, and they run in a 1,000-volt mode. And the bigger piece of equipment is the power supply, and it made a lot of noise, and you could hear the bits go by. Zeros and ones did not make the same noise. But it doesn't matter. Here's our first example of successful transmission. No, it's not the first example, but it's a better one than the first one. And here's Alice's data and Bob's data. And as you can see, there were160 errors between Alice and Bob. And they were not due to the eavesdropper. We checked. There was no one in there. So what we did, the theoretical protocol that I described, again, is all very nice. But if you really want to implement it, you have to take care of all kinds of issues. Let me come back to the issue of single photons. We did not create single photons with this apparatus at all. In fact, there's not even a laser in there. And so instead, what we did was to send very, very dim pulses. Every time that a single photon is called for, instead we send a very dim pulse, and by dim I mean on the average 1/10 of a photon per pulse, meaning that most pulses were empty. About 1 time out of 10, there was one photon. About 1 time in 100, there were two or more. So that the empty pulses were just wasting time. The one photon pulses were secure, and the two photon or more multi-photon pulses were insecure because the eavesdropper could take one of these photons as it passes by and keep it and measure it later on when some more information is available, for instance. And moreover, even if there is no eavesdropper, so there is a security, potential security loophole in these multi-photon pulses. And moreover, even without eavesdroppers, there are errors. So we need to be able to find the errors, correct them, which is going to give even more information to the eavesdropper. And then what do you do with the final string? How can you detect that there are errors? The most obvious way to detect errors is to sacrifice a random fraction. But that's not very efficient. A better way to detect errors is like this. Let's say this is Alice's and Bob's strings. There are three errors here. Another old slide. What it can do is that it can split their strings randomly, meaning that one of them, let's say Alice will tell Bob, put the first, second, fifth, seventh, and so on bits on the upper row and the rest on the lower row. She tells that to Bob in the clear, classically. The eavesdropper hears that, but it's useless. And then Bob does that, and then they compare parity. They compare if the number of ones is odd or even. And if they compare the upper parity, they will find that it's different. And they will already know there is an error. So that is, and it's a fairly simple theorem that if the strings are different, no matter how different they are, by a single bit, by half the bits, all the bits, as soon as the strings are different, when you do that, you have exactly a half chance of finding out that there's an error. So that if you repeat, let's say, 10 times, and if in fact there were errors, the probability that you won't detect it is 1 in 1,000. So that you can build up your confidence that there is no errors very, very efficiently by revealing very little information to the eavesdropper by this process. But before that, it's not worth doing that until, in fact, you've reconciled the strings. So you need some kind of reconciliation protocol that will take these strings. This is the same example, and we'll find that there, and we'll find the errors and correct them. And you want to do that without disclosing too much information to the eavesdropper. There are all kinds of techniques to do that, and I'm not going to spend time on these classical techniques. But Alice and Bob, by talking back and forth, can zoom on the errors and fix them without revealing too much information, because the eavesdropper hears that. So without revealing too much information on their secret strings, they can do that. But at that point, look what happens. At that point, the eavesdropper, if they fail, it's because there were too many errors. And if there were too many errors, it's because there was an eavesdropper, in which case they quit. That's important to understand. If the eavesdropper can force Alice and Bob to fail so that he will not be able to transmit their confidential information, the eavesdropper can also throw a bomb on them to prevent them from communicating. What the eavesdropper cannot do is fool them into thinking that they have succeeded when they have not. And remember that the actual message will not come into play until the quantum key distribution is completed. So it's only once Alice and Bob are satisfied that they have a shared secret key that they will use it through a one-time pad. And before that time, the actual message does not even enter the game. And that's why it's secure. Not only can you detect an eavesdropper, but you can prevent eavesdropping, because if eavesdropper is detected, you will just not communicate. All right, But at this point, after reconciliation, the eavesdropper has a lot of information about that what should be a secret key. Some information because multiphoton pulses might have been split, meaning the eavesdropper could have gotten information about pulses that were more than one photon without disturbing. Also, the eavesdropper could have the eavesdropper has listened to the conversation for reconciliating and then verifying there is no error at the end. So at this point, the eavesdropper has all kinds of information about that not-so-secret string, which is, however, shared between Ellis and Bob. And that's when this technique that we invented, privacy amplification, enters the game. Privacy amplification is a classical technique. It's nothing quantum anymore. It's a classical technique that allows two people who have a shared binary string, but partially compromised. So Alice and Bob share this string, but eavesdropper has some information about it. And through privacy amplification, they can do something that will shrink the string into something which is almost entirely secret and still shared. And I want to give you an idea how privacy amplification works very briefly. Here's the idea. Let's say that Alice and Bob, here, let's say that we have, we're talking about 8-bit strings. So there's this 8-bit string, which is common between Alice and Bob. So there are 256 possibilities, which are represented by all these dots here. And actually, the string which is really common is this red one, which if you read in binary, is this string. And the eavesdropper has some information about where the red dot is, but not complete information. However, Alice and Bob don't know what it is that the eavesdropper knows. They only have an upper bound on how much information is known. To be more precise, how much Renier information. But I can't enter into that detail. Now, what Alice and Bob will do, they're going to shuffle these strings randomly, by which I mean they're going to apply a random permutation of all these strings, sending this first point over here, sending the second one over there, and in particular sending this red dot over there. So they just randomly, one of them chooses a random function, and to do it efficiently, they need this notion of universal hashing. But to make it simpler, one of them, Alice, chooses a random permutation of all the strings and tells it to Bob, and therefore also to the eavesdropper. And then Alice and Bob both apply that permutation to the actual string they have, sending this dot over there. And the final secret is in which bigger box it falls. So in this case, it's box number 1110. So 1110 is going to be the final secret. Now let's see what happens to the eavesdropper. The eavesdropper has some information about the red dot, which we can represent like this. So because of various things that the eavesdropper has done, the eavesdropper knows that it's one of those strings, for instance. It could also be information which is more spread out in a probabilistic fashion. It does not have to be deterministic like this. And Alice and Bob know that the eavesdropper has restricted the number of choices, number of possibilities, but they don't know how. It could be, as far as Alice and Bob are concerned, maybe the eavesdropper thinks it's one of those or one of those. They don't really know. But what happens is that because of this random permutation that was chosen, the points which are still valid from the eavesdropper point of view are scattered all around. And the eavesdroppers, now the eavesdropper is expected to or would like to guess in which box the actual red point has ended up. But there's no information there. It's just as likely to be anywhere. It's in fact slightly more likely to be here than there. So the eavesdropper would probably guess one of these five dot boxes. However, Alice and Bob have a much clearer picture. They know exactly what's going on. Okay. Let me take a few more minutes to tell you about more serious implementations. So after Charlie and I made this prototype, other more serious people from an experimental point of view decided it was worth playing with that. And there were several prototypes in many places, all kinds of, I won't go through those. But in particular, in Los Alamos, there is a prototype that works over 48 kilometers of distance. Compare that to 32.5 centimeters we had. Except that, let me show you Alice and Bob. Here's Alice, unless it's Bob. Alice sends her photons through a fiber here that goes up the ceiling, that goes outside, out in the field, travels for 12 kilometers, bounces back, bounces back, bounces back, and after 48 kilometers, gets back into the ceiling up to Alice, up to Bob. Now, Alice and Bob being so close, it's not cheating. They don't cheat. But it's something that's kind of, well. This is the Swiss prototype in which Alice is in Nyon and Bob is in Geneva here. And there's a fiber that goes underneath Lake Geneva for 23 kilometers. Now, there is a real Euclidean distance between Alice and Bob this time. So this was done by the team in Geneva, Nicolas Gisin and collaborators. They built a what they call a plug-and-play prototype in which, remember what I said, that these quantum the fiber is not so good at keeping quantum information. But quantum information is messed up by the fiber, but in a deterministic fashion. It's a deterministic fashion. It's not chaotic. It's deterministic, but it evolves slowly with time. So if you send a bright pulse, you can calibrate how your fiber is currently messing it up and compensate for that. If you want to do that manually, it's a mess. It takes hours moving the loops until things are lined up again. But Gisin and company have designed a plug-and-play version in which they put a little box at each end of the fiber, push buttons, and it calibrates by itself, and it works like magic. And moreover, they use, I don't have time to give it, explain what I mean here, but they use Faraday mirrors. And by the use of a Faraday mirror, the errors which are made, instead of Alice sending photons to Bob, Alice sends a photon to Bob, Bob modulates it, and sends it back to Alice. And then Alice measures. And the advantage is that by the use of the Faraday mirror on Bob's side, all the errors made by the fiber on the way there are unmade on the way back, so that there's not even any need for calibration. And so they have this very beautiful prototype, which works quite well. You can also have, this is British Telecom, has prototypes that work over networks, so it doesn't have to be point-to-point. Also, British Telecom has a prototype in which they use the same. There's a fiber which is used between Alice and Bob for an ordinary telephone conversation. So Alice and Bob are talking to each other over the telephone, and over the same fiber, there are these little quanta which are being sent that establishes a quantum key at the same time that they talk, classically. There's also a again in Los Alamos a free space. Prototype, by which I mean that Alice and Bob are, there's no no waveguide between them, no optical fiber. Alice sends photons out in the air, and Bob, who is about 1 kilometer down the line, catches them. Now, the first prototype of Charlie and Me also was free space, but short distance. Right? In this case, it's 1 kilometer long. It works in daytime. And even works at sunset. And sunset is when the sun sets into Bob's eyes. And it still works. They cheat in only one way, which is they high up the atmosphere.